Hi, welcome to UCB's Long Form Conversations. I am your host, John Frusciante, alone, host-wise, in the studio today. Will Hines is on Mars. Will Hines went to Mars. Nice. He was sent to Mars unexpectedly. And sitting next to me is Sypha, our podcast intern.
Hello.
Who will never be anything but an intern.
Exactly. I would like to say I'm intern-less today.
Oh, yes. We're really at half staff today.
Yeah, I have no intern.
Yeah. What are we going to do? And sitting across from me is this week's guest, Matt Little.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hi, Matt.
Sypha, I like that you continue to institute the hierarchy of you are the podcast intern.
You have to pay dues. And you have to let people know what's what.
You are the only one insisting on it. Everyone's like, no, we're peers. And you're like, we are not.
No, I am definitely an intern. How dare you insist otherwise? So there's no Will Hines today. So that means it's just me. And so there won't be as many improv stats and fun, obscure facts about improv. Just a lot of hippy-dippy esoteric nonsense about how you felt when you were learning how to improvise. So
yes, I'm wearing my wrap.
Yeah, good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we lit some incense. We've smudged the room.
Yes, we have. The smudge pot is smoking in the corner as we speak. Ours are cleared.
So I didn't think there was going to be a guest this week, so I solicited a bunch of Twitter questions. So we're going to talk to Matt for a little bit, and then we're going to turn to some Twitter questions about UCB and improv and whatever the hell else is on you people's minds today. Before we start, I want to do something really nerdy and recommend a book to everybody, because I just read this great book called Assholes, A Theory by Aaron James, who is a philosophy professor at UC Irvine.
Okay.
It's a fantastic book. Anybody who is familiar with pop philosophy might have heard of On Bullshit, which is a book that came out maybe 5-6 years ago. And this book is in the sort of spirit of that, where he breaks down, he defines what an asshole is, what constitutes the kind of person who is an asshole,
yeah,
and then talks about, like, here's some examples of them, and then defines why people become assholes in our culture and what we can do about them, or what we should or shouldn't do about them.
Oh, fascinating. So what's sort of an example from the book?
An example of what? Of, like, what kind of person? Oh, well, he talks about, somebody who's an asshole is, for instance, the kind of person that cuts ahead in the line in traffic,
yeah,
or cuts ahead in the line in banks or any kind of line. And it's people who feel like they are entitled to things.
Yeah, that entitled sense of entitlement.
To take advantage of, like, special opportunities without having to listen to the criticism of others, basically. I'm giving a very nutshell thumbnail sketch of what he talks about. But it's this idea that, like, yeah, well, I don't have to wait in line like everybody else. I'm better than everyone else. It's that kind of don't you know who I am mentality.
Sort of like entitlement mixed with narcissism.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's some interesting correlations to improvisation in the book. And one thing that I found particularly interesting is he talks about arguing with an asshole.
Yeah.
And how we fight with these people and argue with these people because we want to be recognized as people and we want to be validated as people.
Yeah.
And it struck me that I think that's one of the reasons why we get into fights in improv scenes, because, like, someone starts arguing with us and we argue back because we want to be listened to and recognized.
Yeah. And it's so interesting, too, because it seems so often when that happens, too, people are like, I want to be heard. I want to be heard. But at the same time, they're not listening either.
Yeah.
You know, they're so busy projecting that they're not accepting any information.
Yeah. And that's generally what fights and improv scenes are, is two people projecting improv and information, not listening to information, not recognizing each other.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's like, you recognize me, you know, you recognize me, you know, and,
yeah,
and instead of, like, wait, I'm recognizing this thing about you right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. And in that so often it feels like it leads to not improvising, but writing.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm, writing while standing, which isn't improvising.
Right.
You know, it's like someone trying to, like almost force the conversation in a direction that it doesn't want to go, or keep it in a place that it doesn't want to be anymore.
Totally. Yeah. So, Matt, this is already the longest conversation you and I have ever had.
Indeed.
So I know about you that you were in Thank You Robot, legendary indie improv
legendary
team. Thank
oh my
you,
goodness,
Robot.
You're very kind.
Well, I mean, you know, Sypha is nodding his head.
I recognize him.
Yeah.
I saw a Thank You Robot show. I was wondering.
Yeah, I
oh,
mean,
thanks for coming
Thank
out.
You Robot is one of the big indie groups in New York. One of the certainly like most longest lasting and longest, like big longevity in terms of popularity in New York City. You know,
oh,
in
thanks.
Terms of the people, number of people who, the amount of shows you've done, the length of time you've done them, the amount of people who know who Thank You Robot is, the sort of standard of indie improv teams in the city that you guys have set. So I think, you know, and that's what I'm talking about in that regard. So I know you from there. I know you just started working with UCB Torco.
I did.
Which is great, which we will get into that as well. And I also know that you do Left-Handed Radio.
Yes.
You're heavily involved in Left-Handed Radio.
Yes, Left-Handed Radio is a sketch podcast and monthly live show that we do at UCB East.
Mm-hmm.
We basically what happened there was Adam Bozarth and I had been working together for a while. We'd been trying to like do some sketches, maybe put up a spank, and we would write stuff and we would sort of collaborate with other people, and we would get just to the point where things were starting to take off. Like we started a sketch group with Don Finelli and Mike Scollins and Dom Manzolillo, and mm-hmm. the five of us called ourselves Mr. Clark.
Okay.
And we wrote a whole show when we were revising it, and then we started shooting videos, and just again where we got to that point where it was going to happen, everything just kind of fell apart because people got too busy. Uh-huh. And then Adam and I were talking about how frustrated we were, and in the conversation we talked about how much we missed sketch albums, like oh, like the old like Sandler albums or
yeah.
like Bruce McDonald or
Bruce McCullough.
Bruce McCullough. Did I say McDonald?
You did. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Yummo confused there. Michael McDonald and Bruce McCullough.
Yeah, yeah.
They're easily confused.
I wish they would make that person.
Yeah, right? So we were talking about that, and then we realized that like podcasting was this really easy way to do that every month. So mm-hmm. why not record all this stuff and release a half hour of sketch every month? So
sure.
we started doing that, and we're 2 years in now, and mm-hmm. it's been a lot of fun. I really, really, really love it.
Yeah, and you guys did very well in the Earwolf Podcast Challenge, right?
Yeah, yeah, that was, oh man, that was a summer of nightmares. We
How so?
Were, oh man, so every week we would have a new challenge, right? And mm-hmm. we would have to meet on, say, like a Monday night and
okay.
get a Skype call with Matt Besser.
Mm-hmm.
And earlier that day, we would get an email saying, this is what this week's challenge is going to be. You're going to have to produce a piece based around this.
Okay.
And the tough part was that most of the other shows were interview shows, but we're a sketch show. We're like
oh,
fully
yeah.
produced on the back end. So everything that we do has a couple weeks of production time,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so a lot of what we were producing had to be produced that week within like 4 days. So there were a lot of late nights and us
wow.
sort of starting to snipe at each other and driving each other crazy.
Sure.
And when we were finally, we made it to the final three. And when we were eliminated, we were upset and relieved and exhausted all at the same time.
You're upset because, like, you just sort of wish it would be over with by
yeah.
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we were, I should also mention at the time, Taylor Moore was also in the group. And Anna Rubinova, who's still in the group, mm-hmm. Also very funny
yes.
Performer. All five of us at the end of it, we went out to get drinks, and part of it was like, man, F this. This sucks. We got eliminated. That's bull. And then 5 minutes later, we'd be like, oh, well, we have our summer back, but the
right.
summer's over. Oh, that's bull.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bouncing back and forth. But I feel like that's the sort of thing that happens in any sort of high pressure opportunity, right?
Sure,
like
yeah.
You get frustrated and you're excited, and mm-hmm. I don't know. I kind of love those scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's that kind of like high pressure that you know has given us great shows like Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, the pressure cooker that has brought us Carpool and Cavemen.
Yes, yeah,
Daddy-O. Well, you were on Project Improvisor.
Yes,
years ago,
I certainly
so
was.
You sort of
yeah,
know that sort of tension of.
Right. Right. Yeah. The tension of a, like an imagined reality show environment.
When
you create
stakes in a, like you're already making something and then you just throw stakes onto it and all of a sudden it sort of shifts the dynamic, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, so you guys did that. You, and did you, how much of a bump in your popularity and listenership did you experience from that?
We saw a pretty immediate bump. Mm-hmm. We saw a really big bump. And we've been fortunate enough to kind of maintain that through ever since then. So that was about a year ago. And we noticed like listenership comes and goes, like it goes in waves. Like some, there'll be a couple months every year that it seems starting to seem like the pattern is like people trail off. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's right around the beginning of the summer where it seems like people are starting to listen to podcasts less. I don't know if they're busy with, I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe then, they're listening to music for their road trips.
Yeah, yeah. 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 Which, what?
Yeah. Why?
Come on.
Come on. Music is a dead medium.
Music is a dead medium run by crooks and thieves.
What makes a good, what's the key to good audio sketches or a good audio sketch podcast?
In what sense?
What do you think makes, like, you were talking about how you missed, at, you know, comedy albums and things like that. What kind of things do you try to emulate when you make yours? What do you think, rather, what do you think makes people want to listen to audio sketches? What do you think will hold somebody's interest?
You know, I think that it has to be clear and, like, it has to be funny, but it also has to be clear because the tough part about doing audio sketch versus like on stage or a video is you are removing an entire sensory experience from the person that is experiencing it. So like with video, like video and stuff, you have visual. So you have the sort of visual shorthand. You take all of that away. So you have to find a way to create a picture in someone's head without being sort of heavy-handed and saying like, oh, look, you're sitting on that red chair right now.
Right, right.
And boy, it smells like this.
So what do you think the techniques are for that? What's a shorthand that you've kind of developed or things that you are like, anything, any kind of art that you practice, the more you practice it, the more it's like,
sure,
this thing that once was hard is now like, oh, I know how to do this easily.
Well, you know, and I think because all of us come from an improv background, what's been beneficial with that is, you know, in improv, a lot of times you want to get the, you want to establish the setting at the top of the scene as quickly as possible.
Right.
And it sort of lends itself the same way because you only have the visual of two people on stage in improv. So you have to sort of establish through conversation where you are and what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to sort of incorporate that, like, you know, either we'll set it up with sound effects, like establishing. So like if we're at a mall at Christmas, we'll start with like a background of some like Muzak and some sleigh bells and stuff. Okay. And then we'll sort of bleed a crowd in and then say something like, you know, the mall looks beautiful at Christmas, just to kind of get us where we are or where we need to be.
So it's almost like it would be like starting an improv scene with support moves in a way. Like it would be as if you were starting an improv scene with like lay-ons and
someone steps out and says, you know, we see Holly.
And people on the back line doing like sound effects and things like that.
Yeah.
It's sort of that equivalent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and you guys do you've been doing this every month for a while now, a show where you get people to write a page of dialogue from a movie script.
Yes. So Brett White, who's now sort of with Left-Handed Radio as well, he and I have another podcast called Matt and Brett Love Comics, where we take people who have never read comic books before, read a book and discuss it like a book club with them. And we're always looking for like fun comic book stunts, and we thought it would be fun to make this script for Spider-Man 4 before Amazing Spider-Man came out this summer, where we took we picked 25 of comedy writers' friends and asked them each to write a page, but they can only see the page that comes before theirs.
Okay.
So the plot was insane. And when we got the final script back, it was so weird and fun, and we didn't know what to do with it. So we had a Left-Handed Radio meeting, and all of us had written on it anyways, and we said, well, why don't we just make this our live show? And we put it up because we were burning ourselves out again trying to make studio sketches and do a live sketch show like every month. And the studio the studio shows just kind of fell by the wayside. And we realized once we put Spider-Man 4 up that this was a much more fun way to do a live show.
Sure. Sounds like it.
It's still sort of in the realm of what we do.
Uh-huh.
So we called it the sequel machine, and now we do a sequel to a film franchise.
You've done Batman, right? You've done Spider-Man. This month you're doing Harry Potter.
Yeah, and we did Ninth Mare on Elm
That's
Street
right. yeah.
in October okay. as well. and it's really fun, and it's fun on the producing side to get the pages in from people
sure.
and see like as they're coming in and knowing what I've already seen in the script and what's happening now, just like shaking my head. We get some really weird fun coincidences, like on Dark Knight 4, more than once separated by like a dozen pages so you know the people didn't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. People said that, you know, Alfred comes in, he talks like Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins. And it was like the exact same description more than once.
Two people said that?
Yeah.
That's great.
And the audience loves when weird coincidences like that happen within the script. it's a really fun, weird show that we do as a staged reading. And the audiences are starting to understand what the show is now too, and like really get into seeing stuff like that happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. When is that show?
Our next one is Thursday, December 6th at 11 PM at UCB East.
Great. So everybody should come to that.
Yeah. You should come out to it, and laugh as loud as you can, because we'll be recording that for the podcast.
So this is your opportunity to get your laugh on a piece of recorded, on a recorded show.
Yeah.
Your laugh will be around forever.
Immortalize
yourself.
That's
the word I was looking for.
Immortalize yourself. Make yourself as if you were the immortal Hulk Hogan, but on a podcast.
That's right.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Thank You Robot for a little bit, for crying out loud. Why not?
Yeah.
Well,
Thank You Robot.
Yeah. So how did you get... we ask this question all the time. How did you get to improv? What was your path? How did you get to UCB, or how did you get to Thank You Robot, or both?
Sure. So I was one of those people that I've always wanted to do comedy. Mm-hmm. I've always wanted to act and produce stuff and perform. And when I was in high school, I didn't know how, because everything that they did in high school was a musical, and I cannot carry a note. It's really bad.
Right.
I warn people at karaoke, like I can sell it. I'll sell it like I'm Axl Rose
right.
at the Tokyo Dome. But the voice that comes out is horrible. And people are like, I'm sure it's not bad. And then I start singing and I watch people wince, which is okay.
Because you've already introduced them to the idea that it's going to happen.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
It's their fault for reacting like that. You told them it was
exactly.
Be
look,
like that.
I put you in on the ground floor, man. I gave you the packet. You had all the notes.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really. I never really did any like theater or anything in high school.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to college, I didn't have the confidence to do the theater program.
Okay.
But I started in like the offshoot theater program at Penn State called No Refund Theater.
Okay.
And met a lot of really great, met Mike Still over there.
Okay.
When we were in college through mutual friends of ours. And we started, at the same time I started working with the humor magazine at Penn State, and we started pulling those things together by my senior year, and we wrote a sketch show that we called, the name of the magazine was Froth, P-H-R-O-T-H.
Okay.
And we wrote and cast through NRT the first Frothfest sketch show, which is like this, saying it now, 90-minute college sketch show. We were
wow.
like, oh, yeah, we got 90 minutes. And now I'm like, oh,
minutes.
God, no.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. But At the time, we had like a dress rehearsal on Thursday, then a show on Friday and a show on Saturday in this like 300-person auditorium. And we were like, "This, it'd be cool if like 100 people over the weekend come." We were just like very low-key about it. And the dress rehearsal, we had like 130 people at dress rehearsal watching the dress. And then we had something like, I think we had like over... 900 people come out. We had
You're
to overstuff
kidding.
The auditorium through both shows.
Holy
and
mackerel.
At that point I was like, oh no, this is what I want to do, and I'll be damned if I can't.
Sure.
So like I from there, I studied like how do you get into all this stuff, and all the notes kept pointing to New York, and UCB was starting mm-hmm. to come up, mm-hmm. and I'd loved the show when it was on TV, so I had some personal stuff happen where I had to move home for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and then once all that stuff sort of cleared up, I had enough money and I moved up here and just kind of jumped into stand-up first, and then took my first class here at March of 06, and that 101, I had Ari Vakidis and
great teacher.
Met Abra Tabak in that class, and thought that she was like one of the... John Robert Wilson always says that he thinks she is like the new Gilda Radner.
Huh.
Like he think like, and I do. I think she's like one of the most talented people I've ever been on stage.
She's
with.
Great. Yeah.
And it was like easy to like go through 101 with someone that talented and 201 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, between 201 and 301 is where we met everyone that wound up becoming Thank You Robot.
Okay. And so you're meeting these people and you're thinking, I like these people. We're getting along. I like the way they play. Let's start a practice group. Was it one of those things where it was like a practice group that eventually whittled down to Thank You Robot? Or was it like this group of people is going to play together?
No, it was a practice. It started as a practice group and whittled its way down. Mm-hmm. Like it did start at like 15 people or something like that. You know, like the fun sort of like everyone's like, oh, we can schedule these things for ourselves and let's do it.
Yeah.
And we did that, and after a couple of months, there was a core of us that kept showing up. Mm-hmm. And we were the ones that always got along in classes and stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
And we were starting to hang out outside of class. And we said, it was like right after Christmas, we said, let's really make this a thing. This mm-hmm. was like January of 2007. We'd been practicing for a while, and we had a regular coach. Ben Schwartz was coaching us regularly at that time, and he said, like, if you guys want to do it, like, you have a core, you guys should get serious about it. So we did, and there was an uncomfortable couple of weeks where we had to ask a couple of people to leave because mm-hmm. they were, like, coming in and out, and I know that there was some personal fallout that happened, which was disappointing, but they're people that sort of faded away from the scene anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
It's
always difficult.
It's always difficult.
It
feels like a relation. It is a relationship.
Absolutely.
In a
yeah.
way, because mm-hmm. like, you know, you're hanging out with these people and you have a business relationship that you're also making personal.
Right.
You know, because you also enjoy hanging out and discovering these things mm-hmm. with these people. And
it's interesting. It's also like a relationship. Like you often don't realize that there are so many other situations out there. You know what I mean?
Like, oh yeah.
If you're not working out in your practice group or somebody else is not working out in your practice group, like it's fine. Like there's other people that you're going to mesh with more.
Oh yeah. And at the time too, like we had, Every time that happened, it felt like the end of the world. We had had a situation where we had to ask someone to leave. This was like when we were a team for about a year, and it was like a 2-hour hangout one night where we were all just like gnashing our teeth over it and like really really upset. And then like, and then we asked the person to, and then it all went down. And it went down really well.
Of course, because like, that's
better,
the way it always
but, like,
happens.
We were all like, we're all wringing our hands ahead of time. And we're like terrified that like someone's going to flip a table in public and bring a flamethrower and like, you know.
Yeah, and how often in our lives do we anticipate things like that happening and they don't happen?
They don't.
Yeah.
They don't. Like it's like in your head, I don't know, I'm very much a person that like I build up those situations in my head of like the worst case scenario.
Sure,
and
me
you
too.
Forget that other humans are decent people.
Yeah.
And don't want to do that either.
Yeah. Yeah. We project these like worst fears that we have within us about other people's behavior and like project how we think other people feel about us when really it's like nobody cares.
Yeah.
You know,
I had a, I used to, I don't know, I'm the type of person that very much tries not to be, jealous or upset when I see other people, like my friends, get opportunities and stuff like that, because I'd want them to be happy for me if I got one, you know? And I was, it took me a long time to get to that point where like before that I was, I would get upset. I would kind of get upset, but I realized that like, you can't, you're going to feel better about yourself if you're not getting angry every time someone else gets something. And in fact, it feels a lot better to be excited for them than to sit around and be like, oh, why the hell did that person get on a team? Why did that? You know, and it doesn't solve anything either.
Sure. It doesn't change the situation either way to be angry or happy about it. You know what I mean? What it changes is the way you live your life and the way you hold yourself.
Yeah.
The way you feel about yourself.
And I realize that sort of outlook has helped me sort of grow as a performer too. And like, as not just as a person, but I mean like in my own work.
Sure.
Like Saifa, we were talking about that a little bit beforehand. Yeah. Do you feel like, you said you have like a positive outlook
now?
I
feel like a new man. And, I used to get mad when other people got accomplishments and stuff. And like,
yeah.
And now like I get super excited and happy for them. And I tell them,
yeah.
A big thing nowadays, what I feel, a friend of mine passed away recently, and his funeral was a bunch of people saying how much they loved him. And I was like, did anyone tell him when he was alive?
Yeah.
You know? No. So now I purposely tell people how I feel about them. Like, good stuff.
Yeah. Right. Hey, man, just wanted to bring you to this Starbucks to tell you I think you're a dick.
In case you pass away tomorrow, I want you to know that I hated you.
You need to know this. You need to take this with you to your grave. Yeah. You're a terrible person.
So what's fun for you about Thank You Robot? What has been fun for you and keeps you... What do you think keeps the group together or has kept the group together?
We're all pretty geeky, mm-hmm. and we all sort of operate on the same wavelength. And we all really... respect each other's sense of humor, and we respect each other's performances, mm-hmm. and we just we realized too, because this was the first group that any of us were ever in. It was the first group I ever had, and we realized once we started kind of not drifting away, but like dabbling with other groups and doing other things, that like what we had was kind of unique in that we clicked as quickly as we did.
Mm. Sure,
and we all sort of have a rhythm even now where like we can jump into a show, and even we're all sort of like, I don't know if we're even, are we like warmed up? Are we ready for this show? And we get on stage and like within 10 seconds, we're all on the same page. Mm-hmm. And the ease of performance with each other, I think, and the enjoyment that we get out of doing good shows is what I really, really love about that team.
Sure.
Like I feel like I'll come out of a class and be like, well, dummy, you know, that was terrible.
Yeah.
But like, I rarely ever feel that way coming out of a Thank You Robot show.
Okay.
Even if it's clunky, I feel like there's usually something really fun or really great that came out of it that we all discovered together. And I'm always surprised by them too. Like usually Seth Lind will say at least two things that I would never expect a human being to say in a show. And I'm like, I don't know where you got that or how, but it was really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also, so we talked a little bit about your writing. I saw in your, I read your bio on UCB Theater.
Indeed.
You've also written for Letterman and Saturday Night Live. You want to talk a little bit about that? What capacity have you written?
Oh, sure. So I was a page at The Late Show with David Letterman in 2007.
Okay.
And a few months in, screwed up my courage enough to sneak up onto the writer's floor and introduce myself to the head of the monologue.
How did you do that? I mean, how did you screw up your courage enough? What do you think led to that?
I threw up a lot before.
you were just I have to do this. I have this opportunity. I have to take advantage of it.
Yeah, So someone that I'd noticed, again, because we'd been working with Ben Schwartz in our practice group,
mm-hmm.
I started sort of watching what he had done, and I'd noticed that he had been a page, and I was already like applying to the program anyhow. And I talked to him about getting into like the monologue rotation and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said, you just have to introduce yourself to people. You have to be nice and open. You can't overstep your boundaries. Like, don't go up to like the top floor and you know, but, you know, again, people are nice people. You don't like no one's going to breathe fire at you. You know, the devil doesn't wear Prada. You know, so I had also at the time been writing monologue jokes on my own because I knew it was something that I wanted to try out, and I wanted to get good at it before I even approached them. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that on my blog every week. I was just writing topical jokes and posting like 7 or 8 at the end of the week.
Okay.
And then I went out, so I had enough that I was happy. Like if he asked for examples, I had like at least a page of examples. Right?
Okay.
So I went up and I introduced myself, and he had a stack. I remember he had a stack of VHS in his office, and on the top was a VHS tape of like 40 minutes of adorable cat footage. And I was like, I'm in the right place. So I'd introduced myself, and he was very kind, said that they were full up, but to stay in touch. And I mm-hmm. stayed in touch with him for about 6 months. And then eventually he asked for writing samples. I sent them. And then he said, okay, you can start. You start faxing in or emailing jokes every morning by this time, okay. based off of anything from last night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the theater. I was in the theater working the night that I got my first joke on the air.
Awesome.
And yeah, I was working in the balcony. And again, Mike Still was also there. And he saw me put both of my hands over my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran over into the corner and started jumping up and down like a child. And there are all these people that are like there to see Letterman. And I see them looking over at me and I'm like, oh God, I'm causing a scene. I need to like,
right.
Mike comes running over and he's like, what's wrong? What's going on? And I was like, that was my joke. That was my joke. Letterman said my joke. And then he started doing it too. and then I was like, all right, we got to settle down and people will be paying attention to us instead of the show.
Right.
So I did that for a few years, and then based off of that, I got contact information through friends for the Weekend Update segment at SNL, and I wrote them and told them that I had written for Letterman, and they asked me for samples, so I sent them some samples, and then I wrote over there for I think like a year and a half.
Okay.
And then right about the same time, both of them cut their staffs down.
Okay.
And I was released. Back into the wild.
Right. Like a fish.
Or a goat. Like a sturgeon.
Yes. Yeah. So what was that like for you? Was it, you know, what was your process for writing Weekend Update jokes?
They would send you a list of the day's headlines, mm-hmm. Monday through Thursday. It was like, here's all of the setups. They give you all the setups, and then you have to write the punchlines. You know, so the setup is always like the first sentence that you hear on in a Weekend Update joke. You know, and they would send those every day, and you had like a set amount that you could send in. So I would look at all of them, and then I would panic because I had no ideas.
Right.
And then I'd write a bunch, mm-hmm. and then I'd delete them all because they were terrible.
Okay.
And then I'd beat myself up for a while.
So far, this sounds like every writer's process.
Yes.
Yeah. This is what I wanted to get to the heart of your process and see, like, you know.
It is. I'm very much a writer, too, that, like, when I sit down and I write, I'll write something, and then I'll go, well, that was garbage. You suck.
Yep.
I'm just waiting for like a flashing red red light to come down and like a klaxon to go fraud.
Yeah, the creativity police.
Yeah. Like three.
I think we're all waiting for that.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those things that never happens.
It doesn't.
I've been like, I remember taking a writing class with Joe Toplin, who was a Letterman writer and a writer on Monk for a while. And this is when I had just come back from a comedy break. And I took this writing class, and 1 week was the sketch week. And I was so nervous that I talked myself out of even writing anything. Like, I didn't even bring anything into class. I was so rattled with nerves.
What rattled you the most about it?
Just the fear. Like, what rattled me was the thing that rattles me constantly in my own life. And exactly what you were talking about is this idea that I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that I'm going to write something. It's exactly what you talked about, that I'm going to write something, I'm going to show it to other people or have it read in front of people. They're going to hate it, and they're going to say, wait a minute, you're no good.
Yeah.
You know, I still have that fear today.
Yeah.
But what I always think about is, like, I didn't bring anything in, and the people who brought things in, some of their sketches were so bad that I was like, why didn't I write anything?
Yes.
You know?
It's funny because as I'm getting older, too, I realize that the people that you always thought had it together were just – they didn't really – they were like you always – I feel like you always meet the blowhards when you're in your early 20s, right? The
sure,
people that
yeah.
can talk that big game mm-hmm. and then you automatically assume that they have it.
Yep.
But in reality, you realize that like a lot of times the creative people don't quite have that
talk game.
Yeah, they don't yeah. have – yeah, they literally mm-hmm. don't yet. And it winds up balancing itself out eventually.
Yeah. And I just heard this thing about Dickens. I was listening to somebody talk about a biography of Dickens, or you know, he wrote so much. Charles Dickens wrote. He was like writing his own newspaper. He was writing all these novels at the same time, and short stories, and all this yeah. other stuff. So he wrote so many things. He produced so much. But as this person pointed out, a lot of it doesn't really hold together all that well.
Yeah.
You know, like some of his novels are great, but some of them kind of fall apart.
Yeah.
You know?
And again, too, it like comes back to – it's that idea of like you can't be able – you have to put it out there. And if it fails,
yes.
it fails, because no one will ever – no one can ever take away the successes that happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Spielberg is a director that has made crap too.
Sure.
Like he's made some movies that are not good, and mm-hmm. he's gone on stretches where he's made some movies that are not good. But
yeah.
then he's still Spielberg, and he winds up coming back and nailing it. Or even if he never did, you still have these great things that he's already created in this body of
yeah.
work.
For every like terrible movie that he makes, like Jaws or Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
yeah.
there's Indiana Jones 4, you know,
yeah.
that's like, oh, the
exactly.
guy still got it.
You know what? I knew that he could nail a man swinging like a monkey through a CGI forest. You know what? Knowledge is Steven Spielberg's treasure, you guys. Knowledge is Steven Spielberg's treasure.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about improvisation. Let's go back to
yeah.
improv. We talked about writing. Let's talk about improv. What's the secret to improv?
Yes.
The secret is...
Yeah.
Hello. Oh.
What happened? What happened there? Did we... That was amazing what you just said. I hope that was captured on
yeah,
audio.
Yeah, I do too. I'll tell you what.
Audio.
What do you love about improv? What's the thing that you like... Here, or let me ask you this kind of question. I think everybody I know for myself, everybody who improvises has like certain kinds of improv scenes or characters that they love to play.
Yeah.
What are yours?
I love arrogant doofs.
Me too.
I love the sort of guy that can walk into a room in a three-piece suit and just like ruin everything because he's so confident in himself, but
yeah.
has no business
yeah.
being there.
Here's the branch of that I love. People who are supposed to be like powerful and important people who misuse words.
Yeah.
Yes. People who are so like powerful and arrogant, like political
yes.
leaders or people in a position of power who can't grasp the English language properly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And think they're talking smart, but they aren't. Like, I love that. Like, people with like big egotistical people who don't realize how dumb they are.
Yes. Those are the... It's the like arrogance
mm-hmm.
and the confidence that someone has in that I love that.
Yeah.
That's also the type of character that you know is and is not going to change their stripes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may learn something, but it's still going to be filtered through this weird worldview that they have. Like that arrogant character is still going to be arrogant at the end of that scene. No matter what.
Yeah.
And I love that because those are also characters to me, I think that by nature make assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't stop to ask questions. They process and then make this crazy assumption and it forces other characters in the scene to react.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'm going to give you one. All right. Try to do one for me. Okay. So I'll give you a setup and try to do one of those characters for me. So I finished the inspection of your dance club. There's too many citations here. You can't possibly pass inspection.
I know. I know we can't pass inspection. That's why we have a line around the block.
Well, we can't. We have to turn these people away. We can't let them in.
Ha ha! That is fantastic. Turning people away is just going to make more people want to come in here. Let the rats loose and crank those fog
okay,
lights.
Do not let those rats loose. And those
You're
fog
right.
lights are all on fire.
Don't let them loose. In fact, keep them in the cages and hang them just above head height, above the dance floor.
That's
you
great.
Are. I want to keep you around as an assistant manager.
No, I already have a job. I work for the city.
Ha ha, you do have a job. You work for me now.
Great.
And scene.
That's great. Yeah, I love... are you like... do you consider yourself like a premise guy or like a reacting to an initiation kind of guy, or like what kind of improviser do you think you are in that respect?
I feel like I've been different guys as I have sort of evolved as a performer.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely started as a premise guy. Mm-hmm. Definitely started as a premise guy.
Started as a premise guy.
Yeah,
because that's often a difficult thing to get to.
A lot of it was like I had done so much stand-up before, like in college, and had written a lot more sketch and just everything comedy-wise that I had done approaching long-form improv had been set it up all ahead of time, mm-hmm. you know? So I would be on the back line and I'd be like, okay, have to – Like have to A to Z that. Can't A to C it. Everyone else is just going to A to C. I got to A to Z. And I realized that was causing me a backline panic where I would just be in my head into the third scene because I'm still trying to create the perfect initiate, which will never come.
Never come. What do you think sanded that down? Time, experience?
Experience, and I realized that when I would come out as a premise, and maybe it was the way that I played it as well, I didn't feel as rewarded. I didn't feel like there was as much discovery in a scene. It felt more like me trying to, again, sort of agendize the scene and say, like, this is where it has to go. This is, this is what's going to happen right now. And it didn't feel as fun. And I didn't feel as engaged.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, because with a premise, like, there's a difference between, like, all right, I'm going to set up everything that I want to happen in this scene. There's a difference between that and just introducing, like, here's a premise that I think we can play with for the scene based on the opening or whatever.
Yeah. I had a class with Becky Drysdale years ago who really helped me get to that place because she was very much, you know, just relax and walk into the scene. Like, you don't, even if you don't have an A to C, like if the suggestion was fish, even if you just come out and cast a line and say something about fishing, you've started the scene.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, like, I've never been to an improv show when someone, the audience comes out and goes, you guys, like, that was a great show. Those scenes were great, but fuck how they all started because they were so simple. I've never seen that. You know, like no one ever begrudges you. Like as long as you do that solid scene work within it, and I found that, you know, discovering is so much more weird and fun. And I used to be afraid of doing that on stage because you have to relinquish control.
Totally. Yeah.
You know?
And so much of improv is just letting go of control and like it's acting and reacting in the moment. So you can't come in with like an agenda, as you said, to a scene. You have to be aware that's why we talk about how like the premise is not the game. The premise is the funny idea for the scene. And then the way your scene partner reacts makes the game.
Yeah. And I feel like at times you wind up getting the premise, you wind up discovering the premise after you get off stage.
Right.
Like you wind up discovering that you created a premise together, you know, and sort of like, I feel like you have a great premise when you can explain it in like four words.
Sure. You have a great game, I think, when you can explain it in four words.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And with the premise, like, like you, if you're improvising off of a one-word suggestion, if you're doing like organic, just pure yes and improv, then like you discover a premise on your feet, and afterwards you can get off stage and say like, "Oh yeah, this was the premise and the game for that scene." Yeah,
I love watching you react on stage too in the moment. Oh yeah, yeah. Like there are times when you get hit with information on stage, and like it's so much fun to see it in your face because you're just like, oh, okay, this is happening. Oh, all right,
that's nice of you. Thank you.
Yeah,
yeah. I love that. And just for the record, you were never on Gramps, right?
No, okay. I was not. I have not been a member of a mod team or Harold or Lloyd.
Okay, sorry to hear that.
That's okay. I'm not one of those. Right. Again, going back to like, I'm happy for like in 2010 when the teams got shuffled around, and like that was when almost like the majority of my friends, like my peer group, were placed on team. Like when Frank Hale and Black and Paul and all of those guys. It was that was like the greatest day ever, seeing all those people get placed on teams. And I'm excited every year when that happens. I love whether I'm on it or not. Like,
are you still actively, like, would you still want to be on a Harold team or a mod team?
Yeah.
Or,
yeah, definitely.
Like, when writing submissions come around again, you will submit yourself as a writer.
I can't do writing yet because I've only been through, I haven't been through enough of the sketch side. But
is that something you're working towards or interested in?
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, those are still definitely things that I would love to do, but that's another thing that Thank You Robot has been so great for. And I think like anyone listening that may feel frustrated, like you can still do shows and you can create something for yourself.
Yeah. That's go ahead. Yeah,
well, you know, like at the end of the day, you're the one that's in control of what you, much like in an improv scene, the only thing that you can control in a scene is yourself. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that you can control you can control your own career in terms of like, if you want to do more improv, then go do it. Yeah.
There's a million improvisers in this city.
And like when we started, there was like performance wise, there was Under St. Mark's with the Rogue Elephant show.
Right.
We started a show at Rafifi, which then like closed down like 6 months later. and then Gotham City Improv would occasionally have show, like Bombardo was doing shows over there.
Oh yeah.
But like, That was pretty much it in terms of independent performance. And now there are Parkside Lounge as well. But like now there are a lot of places that are improv friendly.
Sure.
And you know, there's so many shows going up all over the place. Constantly. And people are starting new shows all the time. And
too many.
Yeah. Like there's your Facebook feed will be choked out with too many shows
That's
happening
right.
at once.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is exciting. You can make it happen if you If you want it bad enough, go out there and yeah, it'll suck. It might suck sometimes if you're performing for two or three people, but that's going to happen at any level,
right?
You know, you have to still want to do it, and if you want it bad enough, then go out, keep doing it, and make yourself undeniable. You know,
yeah, that's a great point. All right. I want to get to these Twitter and Tumblr questions momentarily.
Yes.
A couple questions for, you know, I'm interested in this. If you can answer this briefly, you just touched on this and it brought up a question to my mind. Like, you're somebody who, you talked about how you want to be on Mod Night, how that's still a goal for you. Now you're somebody who's like, you write for Left-Handed Radio, and you seem to have a lot going on creatively. Like, what makes you still want to be a part of the system and the process of that? What keeps that a goal for you?
Being part of like
a mod,
or a mod
team, when like you have a bunch of outlets for your creativity, you know, and you have connections and things like that. Why is that a brass ring for you?
Honestly, it's because I love this theater. I love the friends that I've made here. Mm-hmm. I love the experiences that I've had here. I love what gets put up there. I love the level of creativity that you have to achieve to be able to get on those stages. It's exciting. Nine times out of ten, if I could be anywhere in New York, I'd want to be at one of the theaters seeing a show. I love this place a lot, and I feel like I want to give back to it in a way that
sure. How benevolent of me.
but like I want to be a part of that process because of how much the place means to me. And if it doesn't happen, you know, like you said, I try to put my fingers in as many pies as I can. I try to work as much as I can, produce as much as I can, because I know that it's not a guarantee. You know, I get a chance for an opportunity, and if it doesn't happen, then I need to still have an outlet.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Because that's also unfair to like the theater to think like, oh, my entire career is beholden upon you guys putting me on your stage.
Right, right. It's unfair to yourself more than it is to us.
Yeah.
Or to the theater, yeah.
Just in the sense of like, I guess, you know, you hear people start bad-mouthing the theater because like they didn't get put on. It's like, well,
does that happen?
You didn't get put on. Oh, does it?
Do people bad-mouth the theater when they don't get put on teams or when their teams get broken up?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not aware of that.
Once or twice, I think it happened. Once or twice.
Must have been before me.
Yeah.
That's a very good answer. Thank you.
Sure.
What is your favorite inanimate object to improvise with?
Oh, you mean like to create?
No, if you had to improvise with an inanimate object, if you had to do a scene with any
inanimate object. Oh, if I had to come out and it was something that was just sitting out there,
what's your favorite one?
I want a mannequin head with a horse mask on it.
Okay. If you could do an improv scene with any president or live or dead in the audience, which president would it be?
Bill Clinton. Definitely.
Okay. Let's see. I don't have any other questions.
I met him one time.
You met Bill Clinton?
Yeah. I met him. I was volunteering for an Al Franken fundraiser a few years ago, and he came to the fundraiser, and he glides. He doesn't walk. He glides. And, you know, I was like watching the elevator and he walked over to me and I was clearly just like, help. Mm-hmm. And he walked over and was like, hi, how are you tonight? I'm Bill. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know who you are. How are you? Very charming man.
I had another question and I immediately forgot it. So forget it. Let's go to how's Turco? How's working for Turco?
Good? It's great. I really enjoy it. Yeah.
Good.
I had a lot of day jobs before working at Turco, and I was never really happy at any of those.
Sure. I know how that feels.
Sort of balance, but I've realized that like all the skills that I had there apply to this job now.
Yeah.
And I really like coming into work every day. I like making sure that, you know, my friends that are out on tour are taken care of. And I like making sure that the work I really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And it's fun being in the at the training center.
Sure. Now you're a part of, you're a staff member here. So now you know all the secrets. You're in the ivory tower.
I have my Illuminati coffee
that's
mug.
That's right. Yeah.
The secret handshake.
Yep. You've been brought up to speed of all our conspiracy theories and all of our
the
grand
secret handshake
designs.
Involves winking, everybody. And that's all I will tell you.
That's right. Mm-hmm, that's it.
Two snaps and
it's
blinking.
Like, it's like giving away two digits of a phone number.
That's right. Yeah. Klondike. KL5. I was always confused by that for years when I'd see that in old movies. Like, KL5?
Yeah.
Klondike?
Because it used to be in the 80s and the 70s and 80s, it was just 555. And then at some point, they turned it into KL5, which is like, why? Who cares?
Yeah.
We already know it's a fake number.
Yes.
You know?
Bruce Willis said that, I think, in the Twilight Zone movie, like in his segment. And I was like, what is he talking about?
Okay, so before I knew that Matt was going to be our guest, before I asked Matt, before I invited him to be a guest,
I just showed up in the
room.
You
just walked
in.
I was like, what is happening right now? I had solicited some Twitter and Tumblr questions. I said, ask Twitter questions. And if you're too scared to ask me a question face-to-face, you can anonymously ask on Tumblr, because that's what people do now. They anonymously.
But then you posted a really mean picture of yourself pointing
at
the camera and said, you better ask me some fucking questions.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I will find out who you are anonymously because I have friends. all right, so I'm just going to look at some of these and bring some of them up and we can talk about them or I will just answer them. I'm looking at my Tumblr now. Anonymous asks, do I have to be a funny person to do good improv? Yes. Next question.
Follow up by the fact that you asked means you shouldn't. Thank you. Good day.
Here you do. You have to be a funny person to do good comedy improv.
Yeah.
How can the school teach and evaluate comedy when so much of it is a matter of taste? Well, that is because we have a curriculum that we teach by. We know what we believe makes a good improv scene and makes good comedy. We have the theory of, you know, of game in an improv scene, and we have, through years of doing it and figuring out our curriculum, decided that this is how we evaluate it, and this is our system.
Are you sure that question wasn't for an English professor?
It might
college?
Have been. Yeah. I feel like my answer certainly was.
Yes. Well, it's a, but there is a structure. There's a structure to the curriculum.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's my point. Yeah.
And there's there are building blocks within each of the levels that, that walk you towards what are the pieces that help you make a good Herald.
Yeah.
And honestly, a good improv show in general.
Yeah.
Just a Herald form.
We teach you how to do a good improv scene, and then how to like do a good improv structure, how to do a Herald.
Yeah.
And how to like continue to hone those skills. It's not like a bunch of us just sitting around watching improv and being like, no, that's not good. No, that's not funny. No, you don't get it. Yeah, I think that's it.
If you're ever at Herald Night and you hear someone in the back of the room making fart noises with their mouth, it's John
evaluating.
That's me evaluating
your show, yep.
Yeah.
That's what I do at Spanx.
Yeah.
Let's see. What was the biggest disappointment you've had at UCB? Did you want to quit? How did you get past it? I guess not getting on... you know, not getting onto either not getting on teams or being cut from teams were my biggest disappointments. Like auditioning for Herald Night, not getting it, getting cut as a mod actor, just being bumped down to a writer was a huge disappointment for me. Anything like that is anything that disappoints human beings in general is a disappointment. You know, and I've wanted to leave this place 1,000 times, and I don't, because what the hell else am I going to do with my life? Nothing. I'm too deep in it. I don't have any other skills.
You're like a sleeper agent,
yeah,
who's like too deep into the mafia.
Yeah, that's totally what it is.
Only one person knows you're this deep.
Yeah,
and they're in a coma.
All right,
I just described the plot for sleeper.
These other Tumblr questions are good, but I'm going to skip them. There's some good Twitter questions that I got that I want to bring up here. Let's see. Oh, there was one in particular that I wanted. Somebody asked, I think it was Riley. Riley Soliner asked 80 questions to me on Twitter today.
He drank a Red Bull and just started tweeting.
Just started typing.
But wait, another.
Oh, so Riley asked, how much are you allowed to tell us about the theater's work being done during its short closing in December? So UCB Chelsea is closing December 19th through the 21st for renovations. We're getting our seats replaced.
Yes.
I'm allowed to tell you everything about it. We're getting our seats replaced finally. So that people on Yelp won't complain about how our theater is a dive anymore, because that makes me furious. So we're getting new seats, and they're going to be nice, and we might be replacing the carpets. I'm not sure about that, and we'll probably repaint some stuff so the UCB Chelsea will look nice after the weekend of December 21st.
All of the chairs are replaced with fainting couches.
That's right.
And exercise balls.
Yeah.
So all of you Yelpers that were complaining... You're welcome.
So you will be able to look at the person next to you who looks hot because they're sitting on an exercise ball,
yeah,
and faint into your fainting couch.
Yes. Yes.
You were going to ask something?
Yes. What happens to the chairs that are in there now?
I don't know.
Because I would mind taking a row.
Oh, yeah? Well, I
you
would
know,
talk...
Like Shea Stadium?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I want a row.
Like an Ebbets Field seat?
Yeah, I want a row. Or I'll take one, but I would like four.
Okay. We'll talk to Alex Sittis about that and
okay.
See. I don't know
I'll
what we're doing
right
with
in my studio.
That would be awesome.
Well, don't worry. Well, that one's broken. Three of the four are broken.
That one has a spring that's going to
yeah.
stick you in the ass. But.
Yeah, I had to replace the seat on that one with a milk crate. But these are.
Let's see. Jake on Twitter, who is at Jafe Wolfsuck. Not sure what that means.
Oh, man.
Are there plant? When I say I don't know what that means, I'm not making fun of his name. I'm just
no.
I'm
literally,
saying,
there's no sense to what those words don't go together. In that order.
I'm sure they go together for him. Let's see. Are there plans to expand the school, increase the number of classes? Yes, to both. We are expanding the school. Eventually, we're going to move out of here soon into a new building. Can't really talk about that in detail yet, but we are eventually going to expand the size of the school, and by expanding the size of the school, we'll increase the number of classes. He also asked me, Facebook, I jokingly said that I would talk about Stone Temple Pilots' debut LP, Core, if I didn't have a guest.
Let's chat about that.
He,
I will.
The second part of his question is Core too homogenous or too derivative or both? And my answer is neither.
I would agree with you 100%.
It was neither homogenous nor derivative.
What's strange about that is it was such a heavy album.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot heavier, which was so surprising when Purple came out, how much more sort of pop rocky their sound became
a little airier, a little more spread out, I think, on Purple. Whereas like Core is like these driving rock songs.
Yeah, like Dead and Bloated starts out and it's literally just like a heavy riff, and it doesn't like you have like Cracker Man, you know, like it's a, like it felt very much more influenced by metal music than most people would give alternative music credit for.
Sure,
in the early
90s. Well, those guys, the DeLeo brothers, are big Zeppelin fans.
Yes.
And there's a lot of like heavy Zeppelin stuff in there. Let's see. Riley also asked, sometimes my mind freezes up when I improvise with someone I consider out of my league. Has this ever happened to you? Yeah.
Yeah.
It happens to me all the time. Has it happened to you, Matt?
Oh, absolutely.
Has it happened to you, Sypha?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
How do you get out of it?
Try to, if it's a full set, step back onto the back line, count to 10 and relax. Mm-hmm. Because if you seize up, you can't not think because you're seized up because your brain's thinking too much about the situation. Mm-hmm. You have to accept the fact that that person is on stage with you because they think you should be on stage with
them. Yeah. What about you, Sypha? How do you get out of it?
Yeah, like I did a Creek in the Cave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Neil showed up because I was on a team with Sean Casey.
Okay.
So Neil Casey showed up and I froze up and I was like, wait a minute. He came out here to this theater. He wants to do this. He has fun doing this. Why would I ruin that fun for him?
That's a great point.
And I just loosened up, and it was fine after that. It was great after that, actually.
Great.
But I'm like, why did he drive or come to Queens to do improv when he does it at the theater, which is, you know, the goal?
Right.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, just shut up.
It also goes back to the thing that we were talking about before, is that, like, nobody is a monster. You know what I mean? Like, what kind of, like, if you were improvising with somebody who was, quote-unquote, above your league, and you stepped into a scene with them and you initiated or responded and they were like, "What? Why the fuck did you say that, you fucking idiot?" Like, what kind of person would that be?
Yeah.
You know, we don't train people here to improvise like that.
Yeah, and certainly not the people that are like on Herald Night or are on staff.
Right.
You know, those are definitely the people who will not be doing that.
Yeah. Like, you're going to improvise with somebody who, like, wants to make you look good and wants the scene to go well. So even if you freeze up, they're going to, like, justify that and make that look good.
But you forget that the people that you admire so much, they were once like you. This is what's coming to me lately.
Mm-hmm.
They were once scared and in their head and didn't feel comfortable. It's not like they just became a perfect improviser one day.
So I did.
Yeah, you, of course.
I did, yeah.
You form fully formed from Del Close's forehead. It cracked open.
That's right, I'm kind of like Superman a little bit.
So you got to realize, like, they went through, most of them, not you, but most of them, like, what you're going through now.
Right.
So it's just, you know, I've been here, like, I listen to all the stories from the podcast and go, oh, they were nervous too once.
Yeah.
And they were feeling insecure or depressed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like they went through it. Now you go through it.
Yeah. And I still go through it. I think we all still go through it. I think most people still do go through it.
We all only ever get to see the finished product.
Yeah.
You don't get to see the creative process or the lead up to it. Mm-hmm. You know, like no one's ever heard like the first beat Kanye made. Right? People probably have.
Right.
But I bet you compared to like what he does now, it was nothing.
Right.
You know?
Let's see. Matt Visconage, big UCB fan, UCB student now in Chicago studying, asked, where would you like to see UCB in 15 years? Where would you like to see yourself within UCB improv-wise in 15 years? I'd like to see UCB in 15 years, I guess.
This is written by someone who must be much younger.
15 years. Yeah, that's a long time, but I'm assuming we'll have in 15 years, UCB Theater will be like the Hard Rock Cafe. That's what I'm hoping that the UCB will be like. Just big, massive mainstream theaters in major cities, t-shirts, you know, shot glasses, things like that.
Like the Hawaiian Tropic Zone. Take that over in Times Square.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm hoping. Yeah. Yep. There'll be like a 2-drink minimum. There'll be tables in the audience.
Yep. Yep. You have to know someone to get in.
That's right. Yeah.
There will be a bouncer. There will be rats in cages hanging just above the dance floor.
Blues Brothers 3000 will be performing there. Let's see. Another one from Riley. How has improv and game theory influenced other aspects of your comedy? Do you use the tenets of improv in writing stand-up? I know it's improvised every aspect of my comedy or influenced every aspect of my comedy. What about you? Does improv influence your stand-up and left-handed radio stuff?
100%. 100%. It's really great for creating character sketches. Mm-hmm. And the idea of if then and yes and, instead of stopping to make it an argument, mm-hmm. let's have them agree and see what weird place they go to together, mm-hmm. has greatly benefited.
What about you, Sypha? Do you find that it's influencing what you do outside of here, your DJ stuff and things like that? How so?
I said it right before you walked in. I was talking to, what's this guy's name again?
Matt?
Bruce Jones.
Talking to Bruce Jones here. No, actually, it just hit me this week on the radio. Like, I'm kind of sensitive about my weight.
Okay.
And it's not out of control, but I do have like a gut that I hate. And on my show, they make a lot of fat jokes. And when they do, I get upset and I realize I stopped the scene.
Hmm.
And this week, I promised myself I would say yes to everything that was said on my show.
Wow.
And it flowed so much better.
That's amazing. That's a great story.
They made a joke about, because my mom's friend is a transit cop, and we were talking about the guy who got killed on the train.
Yeah, terrible story.
And what happens when if you fall into the tracks and a train is coming, you're supposed to lay down on the track.
Okay.
There's enough room where the train will go over you.
There is. That's confirmed, right? Or that's like generally true, right? Because I hear that and I don't exactly believe it.
Yeah, there's so much more train below the platform that you can easily fit under there.
You'll be stuck in rat water, but you'll be safe.
You'll be alive,
People panic. Uh-huh. You don't want to. It's a massive machine coming towards you.
Yeah.
If you just lay down. So they made a joke that the train would still scrape the top of my gut. And I was like, I'll be gutless. That's it. I'll lose so much weight if I lay on that train. Lay on a track, David.
That's awesome. I love hearing stories like that.
Yeah. And it's in life, too. Just like, even like if my wife was like, let's go to this restaurant. I used to be picky about food.
Yeah.
Now I just go, let's go. If I don't like it, we won't go again.
Right. Yeah. That's great. I love that. Ari Scott, I don't know who this is, asked.
Sounds like a good guy.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Ari. I think you're amazing.
She asked, I've noticed there are not many giraffes on Harold teams. Why does UCBT discriminate against giraffes? This is a great question.
Yeah, you know what? This is actually why Sypha and I brought you here, John.
Oh, yeah? To talk about our discrimination policy against giraffes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, obviously, like with so many other things, we actively discriminate against giraffes. We don't believe that they're funny. There's a grand plan amongst the theater to keep giraffes out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Must have been a giraffe that asked that first question. Do I have to be funny to do improv? Yes, giraffe, you do. So take your dirty long neck.
I thought they didn't want giraffes because their heads would hit those shit buckets on top of the theater.
Yeah, yeah. We don't have room for them on stage.
Yeah. That's the answer you give people.
Yeah. We were on speaking of which, Nate Dern and I were on the Beginnings podcast, which I guess will come out soon. I'm not sure when. But without getting too deep into it, like we talked about, like, you know, how people think there's some kind of grand conspiracy theory or these like machinations behind like what we do and who like gets kept out of like keeping giraffes out of the theater and everything. And I said, like, without to get too deeply into it, I was like, I'm too tired to have the time to like decide to discriminate against types of people or things. Like, we're too busy and I'm too tired
it's amazing that you think enough of yourself that you think that my life revolves around torturing you.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It's great,
but
no. I have
so much to do and I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I don't have time to think like who can we keep off stage and how and why.
John probably doesn't remember. Like, we'll have to be reminded.
Like, I've talked about how I want to do a big episode of the podcast where it's just like addressing rumors and conspiracy theories.
Oh, man.
But for
some reason, it never happens.
It never happens because it's a conspiracy.
Conspiracy.
So we can get more into that when that happens. But it's really like, I'm too busy to like decide that certain swaths of people won't succeed here.
Yeah.
Here's a question that maybe you could answer, and we'll wrap this up because we got to get out of here. Maybe this will be the last question we do. So this is also from Ari. She says, serious question. My mom recently asked me why sketch teams use music for transitions as opposed to just letting the audience clap. She follows it up. She said, I said, I think to keep the energy up, but she was like, well, if it's good, the energy will be kept up. Honestly, didn't know the right answer. That's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
And I think it's not just to keep the energy up. It's partly that, but it's partly to keep the audience engaged and focused while costume changes and set changes are happening.
Yes, I agree with that. I think it is... I just think it's like a shorthand sort of trick to keep the audience's senses engaged, because if there is just silence and they sort of stop clapping, then the energy in the room by default sets back to zero.
Yeah.
And then you have to bring them all the way back up again.
That's right.
Through the sketch.
Yeah.
And you want to create – you want to establish a flow and a rhythm when you're making a,
totally.
A sketch show.
Yeah.
Which is why you sort of program – you sequence the sketches in a certain way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you allow the audience to sort of step back out of the experience and reset themselves back to zero, then you have to re-engage them.
That's right. That's also why you don't want too many transitions or videos in your stage sketch
yeah.
show, because it – I believe it distracts from like the focus of the and the energy of the show.
It becomes a Weird Al show.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nate Bennett, who's a student here, a friend of mine, asked, Ruru was said to have brought back the mono scene. Are there any forms that you see making a comeback lately? Yes, Airwolf is bringing back the Evente.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys have been killing it with that.
I think, you know, there's that and there's, yeah, I think that might be, there's, I think, like, I've seen some, like, organic Harolds and some, like, monocene Harolds happening at Harold Night. So I think, like, if anything, there might be, I think that's part of it, is there might be some, like, fun playing with the form of Harold making its way back to Harold Night, which is always a good thing to see.
Yeah.
Jeff Garlock wants to know why Sean Clements is so damn good at make-em-ups. It's a natural gift. He's a brilliant person.
He has the crimson gem of Sitarak.
Okay. Thank you for your Twitter questions and Tumblr questions. Sorry I didn't get to all of them. Screw you.
fuck you, giraffes.
I'm going back into my ivory tower now.
Yeah.
Anything else that you want to tell us, Matt Little? What's coming up for you besides the Sequel Machine? Anything you want to talk about?
Sequel Machine, Thursday, December 6th at 11 p.m. at UCB East. Mm-hmm. It'll be Harry Potter 9 and 3 quarters. Third Friday of every month at Under St. Mark's. Thank You Robot has our show Summer Fridays.
Okay.
Friday, December 21st will be our musical show. We attempt to do musical improv.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
It's crazy.
Okay. So come see that.
Yeah, and lefthandedradio.com.
Okay. Thank you, Matt. Saifa, anything?
No. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Bye. See you
Sorry
next
I
week.
Sold so much.
You didn't. We love it. Okay, bye.
Vows are spoken to be broken. Feelings are tense. Words are trivial. Pleasures remain. So does the pain. Words are meaningless and forgettable.